This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And our top story today takes us to Romania in the case of the highly controversial influencer Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan, because in the very early hours of this morning, they both left the country on a private jet headed for Florida in the United States. They both have US as well as British citizenship. Both men were facing a set of serious charges in Romania, including rape and sex trafficking, and until yesterday, they weren't allowed to leave the country. Then, abruptly, the terms of their remand changed and they were given back their passports. The key question is why? Well, as we'll hear in a moment, their case is known to be on the minds of officials in the Trump administration. Both men deny all the allegations. In 2023, Andrew Tate sat down for an interview with the BBC. Here's a short excerpt.
We have an open criminal investigation. I am absolutely and utterly sure I'll be found innocent. I know the case better than you. I know it intimately and you don't. I have seen all the criminal files and the evidence against me, and you haven't. I know the truth of what happened, and you don't. And I'm telling you absolutely and utterly, I've never hurt anybody, that the case that's been put against me is completely and utterly fabricated, and I'm never going to be found guilty of anything. And it's very difficult for me to answer your in-depth questions because we're sitting here inside of the territory of Romania. I am beholden to the Romanian legal system, and I'm not going to incriminate myself.
Well, the BBC's Nick Thorpe is also across the case. He's in the Romanian capital, Bucharest, following developments for us.
They were arrested initially at the end of December 2022 and finally charged in June 2023. And one of the charges against them has been trafficking, coercing women into filmed online chat centres, online pornography. Also a charge of rape, also a charge of money laundering. So very serious charges, all of which they denied, and they've proclaimed their innocence from the start and said that they trust in the Romanian courts to eventually find them not guilty.
And they were awaiting the court case to begin, but they weren't being held in prison on remand, if you like. What were the conditions up until today that they had to abide by?
They had been now under what the Romanians call judicial control. Both their British and American passports were taken away, but they were able to move around within the borders of Romania. So that was the definition here of the control, the restrictions on their movement. But so what actually changed overnight, effectively, or yesterday when their passports were returned, was that they had all along been making two appeals to the Romanian justice system through their lawyers. One was that they be released and the charges against them dropped. That hasn't happened. But their request to be able to travel freely, including to travel to the United States, which they're also citizens of, that was granted. So that was the big change. But the investigation against them continues. But I have to say at this point that they'd also won some recent advances or victories in the Romanian courts, according to which the judge in the Romanian court had basically pushed the case back to the prosecutors, saying that there are so many charges involved here and different allegations from different witnesses, alleged victims, that the judge asked the prosecution case to basically make a decision on what they want still to prosecute them for and what they don't. So there was a kind of legal lull in all of this, which I think helped the Romanian prosecution service to say, basically, we're under all this US pressure, although they haven't said that publicly, but clearly they were from public and private statements from the US and Romanian side, and have decided to let them fly off, you know, back to the United States.
Is there any concrete evidence that this was as a result of pressure from the US and in particular the Trump administration?
Yeah, they're saying that the Americans had raised the case more than once, expressing interest in the case, but the Romanian Prime Minister said that he did not regard that as, you know, a demand as such, that this was made informally. But from my private conversations with Romanian prosecutors, I think it's quite clear that had Donald Trump not won the election and had those representations not been made publicly and privately, the Tate brothers would still be on Romanian soil now.
And Nick, is there a bigger picture here with what's going on with Romanian politics and the fact that last year's election was annulled? And I know that came up in Vice President J.D. Vance's speech the other day, didn't it?
Absolutely, yes. No, I think there is a backstory, or the two stories dovetail to some extent. Romania is effectively in the crosshairs of the Trump administration, both over the Tate cases and perhaps more international importance, perhaps, or democratic importance, over Calin Georgescu, this very controversial right-wing figure who came first on the 24th of November in the first round of the presidential elections, which were consequently annulled by the Romanian Constitutional Court on the grounds there'd been blatant Russian interference, which led to his victory. Mr. Vance was also pressuring Romania to allow Mr. Georgescu to run again on the rescheduled elections in May, and yet Mr. Georgescu was arrested, also in a rather dramatic style, stopped in traffic on his way to declare his candidacy for those elections yesterday, and he's now facing six charges of his own. So perhaps we're seeing here, just to bring this together with the Tate release, sort of Romania coming under pressure for two issues, giving way to the United States administration on one, but not giving way on the other.
Nick Thorpe in Bucharest. Well, the Tate brothers are also facing similar allegations in the UK. Matthew Jury is a lawyer representing British women who say they too were victims of their activities.
It's not my reaction that's important. It's the victims of his alleged crimes that's important. And they are disgusted, distraught, dismayed. They're traumatised by this, to think that the most powerful man in the world, Donald Trump, and his administration could bully the Romanians into letting them go. They just don't understand how this has happened.
And is that what you think has happened? I mean, is there any evidence that the Trump administration did put pressure on the Romanian authorities to do this?
Well, it's been reported and publicly admitted by the Romanians that the Trump administration raised the issue of the Tates with them.
Well, they said that, yes, they said they raised the issue, but they didn't say that necessarily they had been told to change the terms of the ban, did
they?
Well,
firstly, I don't fully believe, you know, what the Romanians have said in their response to press inquiries, but we all know how this works. We've all seen The Godfather. You know, you raise the issue and you expect results, and that's what the Trump administration does. I imagine they were explicit, but even if they weren't, the implication was very clear. Allow the Trumps the Tates to leave or else.
The Romanian authorities have also said they're expecting the brothers to return as and when they're called, possibly next month, as the case continues, and it is continuing there. Do you think they actually will?
No, I think that's fanciful. And I think if they do, it'll be because a deal has been struck in advance that the prosecution will be dropped. I do not see any world in which the Tates return to Romania where there is a risk that they will be detained or convicted and imprisoned.
What charges are they facing in the UK? Can you just remind us?
The charges they're facing in the UK are multiple counts of human trafficking and rape, so very serious allegations.
So if they do end up in the US and they stay in the US, what are the chances that they might one day be extradited to the UK to face those charges?
Well, I think that's in part down to the UK authorities and the British government as to what action and steps they'll take now. I would have thought the British government should be acting immediately and urgently to seek their extradition. We know that Starmer is in the US today with Trump. We know that he has, you know, a very busy agenda and that Ukraine is at the top of it. But I think it would be utterly remiss and an abdication of the UK government's responsibilities not to speak up for these women.
He has got a very full agenda. I mean, is it really realistic that he'll raise this case?
He does have a very full agenda, but he has a very big team who can also speak to their counterparts in the Trump administration. So I don't think that's any excuse, quite frankly.
I mean, there have been very few, possibly no recent extraditions from the US to the UK. Is that right?
We know that in the past, extradition from the US to the UK has been problematic. But that does not stop the British government from at least making every effort to ensure that it happens.
So is it your fear that if they've left Romania, they don't end up in the UK, that in fact the brothers will never have to answer the charges of which they're accused?
I think that's a risk, yes.
Lawyer Matthew Jury. An estimated 40,000 residents of four refugee camps in the Occupy West Bank have evacuated their homes in the largest displacement of Palestinians since Israel occupied the territory in 1967. At the weekend, tanks were deployed as the country's defence minister announced plans for a prolonged presence to tackle terrorism, saying residents wouldn't be allowed to return. Paul Adams reports.
I'm looking down the hill here to the eastern edge of Tulkarm refugee camp. It's a densely packed area of houses built right next to each other. But in the middle of it, there's what looks like a street. But it's not a street because there were houses there a week ago. The people in those houses were given 2 hours to come and collect their belongings before the entire area was demolished.
When Israel's military operation in Tulkarm began a month ago, camp residents were given very little time to leave. In the offices of the local Palestinian Authority, we found displaced people with a host of problems. Ala Ofi's wife is about to give birth. He needs paperwork but hasn't been allowed home to get it.
The army forced us out. Me, my family, my wife, we took nothing with us on the way out. We left our documents behind, our clothes and everything we had at home.
Israel says the army had no choice but to enter the camps. It's here, the government says, where acts of violence are planned against soldiers and civilians alike. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, donned a flak jacket and went to the West Bank himself to drive home the message.
We're entering terrorist strongholds, flattening entire streets that terrorists use and their homes. We are eliminating terrorists, commanders. We're doing very, very important work against Hamas and other terrorist organizations desire to harm us.
The main road into the camp here in Jenin is a desolate scene. Earth bulldozed to the sides of the roads, shop fronts damaged and huge puddles of water in the middle of the road. These camps have been around for 75 years. They've never been evacuated like this before. Israel says everything it's doing here is about security. But this place is home to more than 20,000 people. And they're being told they may not be able to go home for a year.
Around 40,000 people have been displaced. Some families have moved into public buildings. Others are staying with relatives or in rented houses. For the children playing here in the grounds of a charity for the blind, education has stopped. Majida Zoueda is here with her children and grandchildren.
They told us to leave and that they would later tell us when to come back. Up until now, it's not clear when we will be able to return to the camp. We wake up every morning in the hope we go back. However, there's still little hope.
With the war in Lebanon over and the war in Gaza on hold, Israel is focusing its attention on the West Bank. The government says the threat posed by armed groups in the camps is real. But in dealing with it, Israel is doing a great deal of damage. This isn't Gaza, but lives and homes are being destroyed with no immediate end in sight.
Paul Adams reporting from the occupied West Bank. You're listening to NewsHour. Still to come on the programme, we'll speak to the archaeologist who's just uncovered an ancient wooden circle with links to Stonehenge at a construction site in Denmark.
We knew there was something there, so we put it up for excavation. And when we start pulling off the dirt with the excavator, we were following this line and it's like, oh, it's curving, it's curving, it keeps curving. And then I just say to myself in my head, it has to be a timber circle. There's just no other explanation.
More on that in half an hour. Our main headlines from the newsroom at the moment. The imprisoned Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan has urged his PKK rebel movement to disarm and end its four-decade fight against the Turkish state. We'll get more details on that also in about half an hour. And on this, because the Hollywood star Gene Hackman and his wife have been found dead in their home in New Mexico, we'll be remembering a remarkable career. This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Thousands of people from all over the world are currently stranded in Myanmar after they were freed from the scam compounds where many of them have been forced to work. Thailand began an operation earlier this month to try to shut down the compounds, which have proliferated along its border with Myanmar, cutting power and phone links and causing the armed groups which were supporting the scams to start freeing the workers. However, with so many nationalities involved, Thailand is struggling to process the workers and has halted their movement across the border, leaving them in makeshift camps with very limited food and sanitation. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports now from the border.
I'm standing beside the Mui River, which divides Thailand from Myanmar. And at this time of the year, it's little more than a muddy stream. But every time I come back here, I'm astonished by the amount of new building you can see over on the other side. That's in Karen State, one of the poorest and least developed parts of Asia. These buildings are featureless blocks in closely packed rows. They are the notorious scam compounds, which have made their mainly Chinese crime bosses immensely rich by defrauding people all over the world and using trafficked labour. Well, now thousands of workers have been freed over there, and yet they're still struggling to find a way home. Earlier this month, 260 from 20 different nationalities were ferried across the Mui River and taken to be registered in Thai army trucks. Another 600 Chinese freed from scam centres were taken directly to the local airport and flown, zip-tied and with police escorts, back to China. But thousands more are still stranded in overcrowded makeshift camps, guarded by nervous soldiers from the same militia groups which once guarded the scam compounds but have now decided to release them. When asked, nearly all say they want to go home, but it still isn't happening. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. This is Jonathan.
Food is limited and sanitation is appalling. I managed to speak to Mike, an Ethiopian, who was forced to work for a year in a scam compound.
The conditions we are in is very hard. We are sleeping on the floor. The toilets are very messed up by now. The food, they serve food twice a day, but the food is not sustaining us, not much. But we are not complaining about that at all. We just need to leave this place because we are suffering beyond comprehension, beyond comprehension. We just need to leave.
Mike's greatest fear is that if they're not allowed to cross over to Thailand soon, they'll be handed back to the Chinese scam bosses and punished as they were before.
It was very bad. It was the worst experience in my life. It was very bad, I swear. Of course, I have been beaten. I have been beaten, and believe me, I have seen a lot worse than this.
Thailand says it's going as fast as it can, but has limited capacity to screen everyone who comes over. Many of the freed workers are also getting little help from their own governments. They've often lost everything, even their passports.
Unfortunately, it seems we're in a bit of a standstill.
Judah Tanner runs an NGO which has spent years trying to help trafficked workers get out of Myanmar. He's alarmed by what he's hearing from the thousands, like Mike, now out of the compounds, but still stuck on the other side of the border.
Unfortunately, we are hearing distressing information about lack of sanitation and toilets. We're understanding that one of the compounds that has about 400 people in it only has two bathrooms. A lot of them were actually screened for TB and were positive for TB. We're hearing from them that they're coughing up blood. Our worry is that we're not engaging fast enough.
So the place they showed us on the map is here.
Yeah, now I have the almost.
I met Arian, a young Bangladeshi man who escaped from one of the most notorious scam compounds last October. It's very new. He showed me a short video he took of it, still under construction. He's come back to try to free 17 friends who are still over there.
Very hard life, like they will give you electric shock and you are crying and shouting. They have the target every week, $5,000. If no, give two electric shock.
Two electric shocks.
Yeah. Every week, we need to earn for them $5,000. I need to definitely fill up my target.
The Thai Prime Minister, Pettong Tan Shinawat, has promised that her government is working hard to end the scourge of the scammers. But there's not yet any real sense of urgency here in Thailand, about getting the freed workers out.
I just want to go home. I just want to go back to my country. That is all I'm asking.
Like Mike, they're still stuck in limbo between the horrors of the scam business they've just escaped and finding a way home.
Jonathan Head reporting. And Jonathan's been telling me about another Thai repatriation, this one involving a group of 40 ethnic Uyghurs who've just been put on a plane back to China from Thailand. Was this group of Uyghurs then seeking asylum in the country?
They were. I mean, this goes back a very long way. They're part of a group of around 350 who arrived in Thailand in very early 2014, so 11 years ago. The women and children were allowed to go to Turkey. Back in 2015, 109 of the men were blindfolded, zip-tied and sent back to China, where they promptly disappeared. Following that, there was a massive bomb in Bangkok, which is largely widely blamed on Uyghur militants. These last, there are 48 in total. Five of them are serving a prison sentence. Another three, we're not quite sure, they haven't been sent back. They've been hanging on. And to give you an idea of how desperately they did not want to go back to China, and they really didn't, I mean, they were absolutely phobic about it, the conditions they've been kept in Thailand have been absolutely appalling. Five of them have died. It's been a scandal, and it has been an embarrassment for Thailand. The Thais really didn't know what to do, because they probably could have got them to Turkey to join families with asylum there, but China has been putting enormous pressure on both countries to make sure they go back to China. It looks like they were going to send them back about a month ago, around the time of Donald Trump's inauguration. There was a huge outcry. They backed off. Now they've done it. And I think they've probably chosen their time pretty well, because the world is so distracted by what's going on in Washington and elsewhere, in Ukraine and the Middle East. I think the Thais hope they'll get away with it. But a lot of people here are shocked that they've done it. Thailand took a place on the UN Human Rights Council this year. It does normally pride itself in being rather more liberal than its Asian neighbours. But these 40 Uyghur men have gone back with a police escort on a Chinese chartered plane to Xinjiang. And while the Thais have extracted promises that they will be well treated, I don't think anybody really believes those.
Presumably, Thailand has international obligations to examine their cases. I mean, has it said anything officially about its decision to send them back?
Look, it's clearly embarrassed. I mean, they did it in the early hours of the morning in lorries with blacked-out windows. The government wouldn't even acknowledge it. The Prime Minister, the young Prime Minister, who's a somewhat hapless figure, said she knew nothing about it this morning. Well, it turns out this was approved by the National Security Council, which she chairs. So their credibility, it doesn't look good at all at the moment. I think in the end, I mean, they tried to explain it by saying, well, we couldn't find a third country. That is because China wouldn't put so much pressure on Turkey, the obvious third country, that they couldn't go there, that they had no choice after all this time. They did have a choice. They could have kept them. They could have kept them in better conditions. But the pressure from China has been relentless. And I know this from sources in the government, constantly calling up. China is very aware now that the US's prestige, Thailand's a US ally, but China knows now it can call up and it can put pressure on and it gets what it wants.
That was Jonathan Head, the BBC Southeast Asia correspondent, now back in Bangkok. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, if you grew up in the 90s, this might make you feel just a little bit older, because today Pokemon turns 29, the name short for Pocket Monster. And in its lifetime, it's expanded from trading cards to video games and to soft toys. Well, for a closer look at the secret of the brand's enduring success, Mariko Oi caught up with the boss of the Pokemon company.
I'm at one of two dozen Pokemon centres around the world where they sell toys, stationeries, cars, you name it. Since Pocket Monsters was released in a red and green version for the Game Boy in Japan 29 years ago, their popularity hasn't died down. The phenomenon has been dubbed Pokemania, and what looks like a simple card game can be sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars, or reportedly even millions. So what's the secret to their success? I put that question to the president of the Pokemon company, Tsunekazu Ishihara.
I believe the original game was groundbreaking because it allowed users to exchange Pokémon that you catch with your friends and other players. So it wasn't an introverted activity, but it became a tool to actively communicate with others. The number of Pokémon, which started at 151, has increased to more than 1,000 today, and their fans also grew and now span across several generations. Our mission statement is to enrich both the real world and the virtual world with the Pokémon characters. Pokémon Go is the perfect example, because you can look for Pokémon in the real world.
What about counterfeits and patent infringement? You recently sued the maker of the hit survival adventure game Palworld. What are you doing about those fake Pokémon?
We've been fighting fakes since the beginning. The more popular Pokémon became, the worse the problem. It affects our creativity, and our customers get disappointed when they receive products that aren't authentic.
Along with Hello Kitty and Super Mario, Pokémon is one of Japan's three big soft power. And the Pokémon Company is the only one that remains private, despite its huge revenue. But Mr. Ishihara says that's not the biggest difference.
Hello Kitty is one of the characters for Sanrio, and Super Mario is one of the characters for Nintendo. But Pokémon is the only thing we do at the Pokémon Company. So whatever profit we make from Pokémon gets reinvested in Pokémon. If we go public, we have to focus on growing our profitability, and our investors might ask, what are you going to do when the popularity of Pokémon dies down? And our answer will be, we'll go bust when Pokémon is no longer popular.
Now here's my full disclosure. I bid for Mr. Ishihara's interview when I realized how popular Pokémon is among my children and their friends. And they were shocked to learn that Ash and Pikachu, who were the beloved protagonists of the Pokémon anime for more than a quarter of a century, had to retire. So I asked Mr. Ishihara what happened to them.
That's the hardest question you asked today. Well, Ash and Pikachu's journey might have ended on camera, but it's only what you see on TV. Even though the TV camera might not be following them, Ash's journey is continuing and his partner Pikachu is right next to him.
I hope you understood that. I don't think I did. That report about the enduring appeal of Pokémon was from the BBC's Mariko Oi. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Gene Hackman, one of the biggest Hollywood stars of the 1970s and 80s, has died at the age of 95. He was found dead at his home in New Mexico, along with his wife Betsy Arakawa and their dog. The exact circumstances of their deaths aren't yet clear, but police have said there was no immediate sign of any foul play. Hackman was hugely prolific. He appeared in more than 80 films and won two Oscars for the 1971 crime thriller The French Connection and for his supporting role in the Western Unforgiven. Here's a flavour.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. What's my name?
I don't trust anybody. I don't love anybody. Hey, we're going to be partners, okay?
Okay.
All right, come on.
Smile when the bulldozer ran over the black kid's body. Get here! Get here!
How do you choose to congratulate the greatest criminal mind of our time?
Huh?
You tell me that I'm brilliant? Oh, no, no, no. That would be too obvious. I grant you. Fiendishly gifted.
Try twisted.
Clips there from The French Connection, The Scarecrow, Mississippi Burning and Superman. Well, film critic Jason Solomons is a big fan of Gene Hackman and he's been telling me why he was such a compelling performer.
I think he was one of those actors that's very rare in that he was a character actor, not a leading man, but he had what we call now these days leading man energy. You know, he was kind of pulling all eyes towards him. He had such a compelling delivery, that gruff voice that you heard in those clips there, but he could deliver it with a kind of staccato hammer blow. And you always watched him. There was always a surprise. You never quite knew how he was going to deliver the next line and what look he was going to do. It's a sort of razor edge energy that he brought to the screen with every part, be it Lex Luthor, the sort of Superman comic book villain, or a real kind of firebrand like Popeye Doyle, for which he won his Oscar in French Connection.
He did have incredible range, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, just the range of films that you even used in that clip, they go from, you know, burn very hard police thriller to comic book. But he was also, of course, in comedy later in his career, like The Royal Tenenbaums for Wes Anderson and Get Shorty for Barry Levinson. And there's a very famous clip of him playing the blind man in Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. So he's worked with Francis Ford Coppola and Clint Eastwood, very serious filmmakers, but he could also do that light touch somehow with comic directors. Everyone gravitated towards Gene Hackman on the screen and off it.
Tell us a bit about The Scarecrow, because I think it's one of your favourite roles for him. And I think it was also his favourite role. Tell us a bit more about that movie.
Yeah, one of his. I was delighted to hear you use a clip of it. It's one of the lesser known ones, actually. So to hear you use a clip of it was great. In fact, he didn't win the Palme d'Or. You know, actors in Cannes don't win the Palme d'Or. The director wins it. But basically, him and Al Pacino play a sort of odd couple buddy road movie in this 1973 film by Jerry Schatzberg, and it's a bit like Of Mice and Men, because, you know, Al Pacino's all small and wiry and Gene Hackman's really tall, and they're sort of deluded con men who go on their way and decide to become friends and strike up a friendship as they go. And they go across the sort of dust bowl of America in a way in the 70s. And it's this kind of trippy, freewheeling paradigm of that free cinema, American New Wave, they called it at the time. And that's the cinema that I'm really mourning today, the sort of cinema they don't make anymore, when the big studios made films that starred people like Gene Hackman, who weren't conventionally beautiful, who had wiry, funny hair, who had kind of a sort of lived-in face. They weren't movie stars as such, but they could act and they could hold the screen. And they always worked very well in an ensemble, like he does with Al Pacino in that, like he does in, say, The Royal Tenenbaums with a whole new generation of actors, like he does with Denzel Washington in Crimson Tide, like he does with Willem Dafoe in Mississippi Burning. You can go on. It's just extraordinary the number of films that are among your favourites that have got Gene Hackman in them. He's the common denominator of quality.
Yeah, I did wonder, you know, if someone like him would get so many roles now. I mean, it seems unlikely, doesn't it?
It does, because of that convention, and also because that sort of film isn't being made anymore, James. And that's what's so upsetting. It's sort of another nail in the coffin for that great sort of studio picture that Hollywood doesn't make anymore, that cinema isn't really making anymore. And it's very difficult to get these films made now. People say that the people don't go to the movies, but they used to go in their droves to even sort of not run-of-the-mill thrillers, but films like Narrow Margin and Class Action and The Firm, those John Grisham movies, which starred Gene Hackman with Tom Cruise. You know, they were big, big movies at the time. People went on Saturday night and they kind of were entertained and they were stretched and they were pulled and they were tested by people like Gene Hackman, who could be complex, they could be vulnerable, but they could also be full of action and you know, fight scenes and chase scenes. He could do them all. But he was best when I think he was being sort of still and looking at the screen, and you just never knew what emotions were burning up inside him.
The film critic Jason Solomon's paying tribute there to Gene Hackman, who's died at the age of 95. Now, it was Winston Churchill who first talked about the special relationship between Britain and the US in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Since then, that relationship, if indeed it is special, has had its ups and downs. Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were ideological bedfellows and close. So too were George W. Bush and Tony Blair, even though they leaned in different directions politically. But will any of that matter when the current British Prime Minister Keir Starmer meets Donald Trump at the White House in a couple of hours' time? They're certainly not political soulmates and very different personalities. But somehow, Sir Keir has to convince President Trump to change tack when it comes to Ukraine's future. And that's because he's warned explicitly that he believes American military support is essential to deter any future Russian aggression in the event of a ceasefire. Mr. Trump so far hasn't offered those security guarantees, and it goes to the heart of the fragile state of relations between the US and Europe. Well, last night at a reception at the British Embassy in DC, Keir Starmer talked about the relationship and made this jokey reference to Elon Musk's plans for the federal bureaucracy.
We want to strike a new partnership. We share the view that our best days lie ahead. And, you know, taking out a chainsaw isn't quite my style. But we are stripping away red tape and bureaucracy.
Peter Westmacott, Sir Peter, was Britain's ambassador in Washington for 4 years until 2016. How high are the stakes for Britain's prime minister today?
I think this really is an important visit for him, to first visit to the Oval Office since the election of President Trump. So the agenda is a very substantial one, and a lot of it is about Ukraine and European security, but there's a lot of other issues, including trade and tariff policy, Middle East issues they should be talking about. I would like to think they would talk about Syria, where the United States has got an important role in trying to help stabilize that country. But fundamentally, because President Trump is so much the dominant figure in his administration, it really is important for the prime minister to ensure that his personal relationship with the president really gets off to a good start. I mean, it's already begun, but if you like, builds on that so that it becomes substantial and productive.
They're clearly very different characters, politically and personality. Does that personal chemistry between leaders matter?
Yes, it does matter. I think it matters all the more when you have got a president like Donald Trump, who is the dominant figure, where a number of the members of his administration wait to hear what the policy is as a result of whatever he's tweeted or said on radio or television. His opinion, his mood varies quite a lot. And whether it's about Ukraine, whether it's about the future of European security, whether it's about tariffs and trade policy, it can be a little unpredictable. So having a strong relationship with the key person in the administration matters more than usual.
How do you strike that balance between flattering someone like President Trump, but also asserting your own position?
It seems that a degree of flattery, or at least understanding what really matters to the president, what are his priorities and what are not his priorities, what is negotiable and what isn't negotiable. At the same time, he will respect people who will stand up to him, not so much to kind of embarrass or challenge in a way that makes it look as though he, you know, doesn't get the facts right or doesn't know the brief, but in a way that takes account of what his concerns are.
How will he persuade Donald Trump that Ukraine does need some form of American security guarantees?
I think it's helpful that in advance of his visit, the Prime Minister has already said that the UK is going to increase its defence spending to 2.5% of GDP in a couple of years' time and then more later. Although the 2.5% in itself doesn't mean much unless the money is spent on really improving the UK's defence capabilities. The Prime Minister's got to try to explain that the wrong kind of negotiation will be bad for Ukraine and bad for European security and bad for America. And I think he can appeal to Donald Trump's desire to be seen as the deal maker in chief. He's got a long track record, he tells us, of having done brilliant deals.
Do you think that Keir Starmer will be trying to make the argument that if tariffs were to be imposed on UK imports from the UK, I mean, he's threatening them on the European Union, but if that applied also to the UK, that actually boosting defence spending is going to be even harder if those tariffs are imposed? In other words, there's going to be less money for defence spending. Is that the sort of angle that he might be choosing to take?
I think it's a very good point. I've actually said the same thing myself on social media. I'm sure the Prime Minister will make that point. I suspect the Prime Minister will also have been advised that tariffs is something to which President Trump is attached. He feels that the terms of trade for America and Europe and China and Britain and a number of other places, even Canada and Mexico, are not fair. What you can do is try to talk down the risk of these being very damaging. You can have a substantive conversation about it, but I don't think it's really worth trying to say to the president, forget about tariffs, it's a bad idea. It may be a bad idea, but I think he's very attached to it.
President Trump really seems to be gunning for the European Union. Do you think it's an advantage that the UK is now out of the European Union?
Because we're not in the single market, that does give us the ability, in fact, the responsibility, to negotiate our own terms of trade and tariffs and free trade agreements if we want to. There's a lot that the UK brings to the table. The UK is a big buyer of US defence equipment. The United States doesn't buy anything, really. And we have assets around the world in, you know, I'm thinking of places like Ascension and Diego Garcia and Cyprus and even in the United Kingdom, where the United States has got priceless defence facilities, which the United Kingdom provides for it. Those, I won't say they give us leverage, but they are a very substantive part of the relationship, which I don't think the United States will want to jeopardise.
I just wanted to ask you one other question. One of our top stories today is the news that the influencer Andrew Tate is heading back to the US, and there's some speculation that this is a result of pressure from the Trump administration. Now, he is also facing charges in the UK. His lawyer has told the BBC that he wants to see Keir Starmer raise this with Donald Trump today. I mean, do you think that is likely?
it is going to be difficult for the Prime Minister in the short time he's got with the President to spend time on even Gaza and Israel. Will he get to the case of Andrew Tate? I'd be surprised, but I'm not in charge of his agenda.
That was Sir Peter Westmacott, who was Britain's ambassador in Washington until 2016 for 4 years. That meeting between Keir Starmer and Donald Trump due to take place, I think, in a couple of hours' time. So do stay tuned to the BBC later on to find out how that went. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us here. Still more to come on this edition of the programme. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, archaeologists in northern Denmark say they've uncovered a new henge, an ancient circle, probably 3,000 or 4,000 years old, that was made up of about 45 wooden posts. And this wood henge, they believe, is almost certainly connected to other similar structures, not just in Denmark, but also across the North Sea in the UK, including England's famous Stonehenge. Cecil Wallin is curator at Denmark's Vesthimmerlands Museum and part of the team that made the discovery.
I was doing the excavation. It's going to be a building site. And so we've done the trial excavation, and I didn't see the circle. I've gone right through it, but I found the post holes, but I just had no imagination that I was going to look for such a large site. But then when we knew there was something there, so we put it up for excavation. And when we start pulling off the dirt with the excavator, we were following this line, and it's like, oh, it's curving, it's curving, it keeps curving. And then I just say to myself in my head, it has to be a timber circle. There's just no other explanation.
So what exactly can you see? I mean, what exactly is still there?
You wouldn't be able to see it if you were field walking. The holes from the posts, that's filled up with dirt afterwards. That's what's left, actually. And then when we do a section, a cross-section of the post holes, we've done it from the first one, and we can actually find bits of charred pieces of the tip of the posts. So that's what's left.
So it's very exciting. I mean, it's quite a discovery, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is also because it connects us to this entire, this British and European henge world. And it's the first time we have an opportunity to excavate such a large timber circle in Denmark.
And tell us a bit more about those links. How does it fit in with other henges, both wooden and stone, around, as you say, northern Europe?
It fits really nicely with some of the British smaller wooden henges, the ones that are found in ploughed soil areas. Also, because we have one of the few other wood henges in Denmark is actually excavated 1.2 kilometers away. And it's a small one, but special with, and its closest link is in Wales.
And what about Stonehenge? Is there a link there, do you think? Are they all part of the same sort of thing?
Yes, they are. That's definitely what I get from Mike Parker Pearson's work, is that they're connected. And it seems Stonehenge was actually built by people who were used to working in wood, because the way they connect the stones is actually sort of a technology you see in woodwork a lot. And some dates from like Woodhenge at Stonehenge indicates that some of these woodhenges are definitely older than some of the Stonehenges.
And so what was going on? Was it that people were moving around from Denmark to the UK, or was it that they were just taking inspiration? They believed in the same thing. These henges represented the same sorts of ideas.
Religion, politics, power, everyday life is so interconnected in this period. So it makes perfect sense. Also, this site seemed to be also a center of power in this period. We have a huge concentration of rich graves, also a very tight concentration of settlement that we don't seem to see in other parts of our area. So it makes sense.
Cecil Wallin of Denmark's Vesthimmerlands Museum. Now, Abdullah Öcalan, leader of the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, has today called for the group to lay down its weapons. The PKK are deemed a terror group by Turkey and other Western nations. Öcalan's been in jail for 25 years. Emily Withers is a journalist in Istanbul. How significant is this?
It could potentially be very significant. It could mark the end of a 40-year conflict that the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, has waged with Turkey that has left tens of thousands of dead on both sides and has had major regional impacts. We've had a letter that was written inside jail from the leader of the PKK, who's based on an island just off Istanbul. He wrote a letter which was then read out as a statement by Kurdish politicians at a press conference in the last hour. And in that letter, the militant leader, Abdullah Öcalan, said that the PKK should lay down their arms and they should dissolve. But there's so much that's unclear right now. You don't wage a 40-year insurgency against the Turkish state without there being any major concessions. And it's just not clear at the moment what those concessions are. It's also not clear whether the fighters who are now based in northeastern Syria, they're based in the northern Iraqi mountains, are they going to listen to their jailed leader who has been in prison since 1999 and not really ever heard from?
Yes, I was going to ask you, how much sway does he have over the rank and file, if you like?
Well, that's not really clear because, you know, as I said, he used to be the leader. He was the face of the PKK. He was incredibly powerful, but he was captured in 1999 and has been in jail since, sometimes in complete isolation. So no one's really heard from him. Meanwhile, Turkey has continued to fight the PKK in the northern Iraqi mountains, in Syria, and within the country. And last year, towards the end of last year, there was an announcement from Erdogan's ally, Devlet Bahçeli. He's a nationalist minister here in Turkey. He announced that there were these peace talks ongoing with the PKK. And then the next day, there was a vicious terror attack, a deadly terror attack that the PKK claimed responsibility for in Ankara on an aerospace industry office that was manufacturing drones that were targeting the PKK in some of these border areas. So that did lead you to believe that not everyone within the PKK ranks were happy about the peace talks going on.
And what about the political dynamics, the context from the Turkish government's point of view and President Erdogan?
There are two reasons for why President Erdogan might want this to happen now. Firstly, if we look over the border into Syria, running the northeast is the Syrian Democratic Forces. They are a Kurdish-led group, which Turkey says has PKK fighters amongst them, and they do not want this group to be on their borders. And this has been a long-running discussion between Syria and Turkey for this group to be dismantled. The complicated thing here is the SDF forces are also American allies. They armed and trained them to watch over Islamic State and their battle against Islamic State in that region. There's also a domestic reason here too. President Tayyip Erdogan is no longer able to run for office after 2028, and it's not clear whether he might want to extend his power. He can do that through two ways. He can rewrite the constitution, or he can call early elections. In order to do that, he's going to need the support from parliament, and he doesn't have that without the Kurdish parties. So it could be that this deal has been struck in order to secure the support from Kurdish parties so he can remain in office beyond 2028. And he's going to need the Kurdish vote as well, potentially, if he wants to win.
Emily Withers speaking to me from Istanbul. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.